Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery. We'll talk comics for the week, as well as whatever news is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And now, on with the show.
Roguecast episode 274, recorded October 22nd, 2019. Bone Beat 'em Up.
So this week we have a lot of stuff to talk about. Notably, of course, later in the show, we'll be giving our spoiler thoughts on Watchmen on HBO, which we have all watched. We watched The Watchmen.
Is it just called Watchmen?
It's just called Watchmen, yeah.
But it's also kind of an unusual episode, or, well, we had a lighter selection of comics to review for our picks.
Yeah.
Because UPS shorted us a box that had a ton of stuff in it.
Yeah. So, I think we got the majority of everything read.
Yeah, and hopefully by the time you hear this, we'll have gotten it in and put it out on the shelf. In fact, it may be completely invisible. That's the plan. But we didn't maybe have the full selection in front of us.
Our listenership will know of our pains in the morning.
Yes, if we look like there is angst in our eyes, just from a little, we'll be doing extra running around, a secondary comics pull tomorrow morning with the extra box.
Or you notice Randy in a heap on the floor asleep because he had to wake up super early.
Yeah.
Yes, let him gently rest. Yeah. Do not prod him with a stick, however tempting it may be.
It's true. That's good advice in general.
Go ahead.
we have some news to get to. So some big news from last week was that Netflix is doing Bone. Netflix is doing an animated Bone series, which... It's about time.
It is. There's been rumors about, like, Bone being animated for decades, literally decades. Yep. They did a video game series that I think was kind of got somewhat lukewarm reception. Like, I think it was supposed to be good, but
it was okay.
It was not one of those ones where it was like a defining adaptation. In fact, the only defining adaptation in a way has been just the colorization from Scholastic books.
How do I not know about this video game? Was it just?
It was a long time ago.
It was a Telltale type game.
Yeah.
Okay. That's what I was wondering, if it was a Telltale or if it was like a Watchmen.
But I think
it's a Bone beat 'em up.
It's a Bone beat 'em up.
That sounds weird.
The three bones. Just town on all of
you hit the X button to beat up on rat creatures.
But it was like 15 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
It was a good ways back. Could have even been more. Could have been like 20 years ago. It would still be. Well, no, I guess it hadn't finished yet.
Yeah.
Although the games could have come out before it finished. I don't remember. My brother picked up one of. I think it came out in chapters like a Telltale game. I think I remember playing one of them there, and I was like, "This is okay."
Yeah, it's about right.
Netflix animated adaptation, that sounds really good.
Yep, I'm all for it. I don't know who's working on it. I don't know what the format's going to be. I mean, I assume they won't try to do all in one season.
No, I wouldn't.
No. They can definitely spread that out, broadly. It could, I don't think they'll do a 9-season thing, which was a 9-volume series.
Right.
But if they did like a... 3 or 4, something like that, I bet they could cover almost all the big beats.
I would say like Avatar, like so 3 seasons.
Yeah. Avatar, I believe, was originally supposed to be 4, right? Wasn't there, I think, like a... Is there one of the elements that didn't get a season?
Well, he was Air. He was already trained in that. The others were all about him.
I thought I remembered hearing that there was supposed to be an Air season, however.
Huh.
I'll have to look into that. I could be talking out of my ass.
But it never aired?
You just aired right now. I have a feeling that... Well... I was about to say that I have a feeling they're going to do a good job with it, but then I remembered that, like, that Watership Down thing was kind of mediocre.
Yeah, that's true.
But what's the one from the
Dragon
Avatar
Prince.
People?
Yeah, Dragon Prince
has been awesome.
Yeah. By the way, Dave, is Legend Korra the heir to the Avatar?
Yes.
You guys see what I have to deal with? Every day.
They can't see anything, Nick.
Okay, you can hear what I have to deal with.
Nick just needs to air his grievances.
Yes.
Jesus. Bone became a staple of, like, I think, school libraries, and for a lot of kids, a staple graphic novel series to read when they were growing up. I can't think of anything comparable. Like, when I was a kid, ElfQuest sometimes showed up in schools, but kind of a rarity. It was certainly not in...
I know you mean the comic, but I had this vision of elves on wolves riding down the hallways of your school. Hey, kids!
We're on a quest!
Yes. Is this where the treasure is? No,
Cutter
man.
Cutter and Skywise would like to speak to you about adventure.
I'd like to go to that school, though.
Yeah.
That would be fun.
Yeah. Sorry. Anyway.
I don't know what I was saying. It's a bone is a big thing. Every kid has read it now.
Yeah, and I still point kids to it these days.
I imagine it'll get a big boost when there's a Netflix show.
You know what's weird is that sometimes, just because of the way like libraries work, and sometimes things are checked out and sometimes they aren't, I've definitely heard parents talking to their kids, and their kids are like, I've read volumes 1 and like 4, 5, and 6, and then 9, and they need to read the others. And I'm like, oh, that's so weird to me. Like, it is one big story in all ways that count.
Or some people who start at the end and go to the beginning. I don't
know. Yeah, it's weird.
You know what's interesting? I wonder if Brandon Telgemeier's got a deal going or something. Doesn't it feel like her, like, guts and drama and all that would be a something that'll get adapted that's such a huge hit, or Dog Man for that matter?
The weird thing is
in 2021 from Disney Plus.
Yeah. There's a bit of a purist in me that's like, I don't want Bone adapted, and I don't want her stuff either, because I like them as graphic novel-only coolnesses in the world.
Yeah, but kids don't necessarily read all those things. You want them exposed to a larger audience, and then they come and read them.
Or do they just become more animation watchers?
That's possible, too.
Is it sad that I kind of wish Disney Plus had Bone instead of Netflix?
No, that makes sense. I mean, here's the thing. You don't know. Disney Plus could be terrible.
I mean, it could be. A couple weeks out?
What if The Mandalorian is really dumb?
I don't feel that that's going to happen.
What if it's like, it's just a guy in like 501st armor, and it's like, I mean, that's okay, but it feels like there should be a higher budget.
True.
Telling me you made a time machine out of a Mandalorian? Sorry, that just popped into my head. I had to get out.
It's going
to
be the Random Association Show. all right, jumping on to Batman news. The movie. Last week we talked about the Catwoman casting.
Yep.
This week they have cast Paul Dano as the Riddler. Nick, who is Paul Dano?
I know the name. I know his face.
He's not the guy from Hawaii 5-0, is he? Bookum Dano?
No, he's not Bookum Dano, but he has actually been in quite a bit, and now I can't remember.
I was counting you, Nick. I didn't look it up on IMDb.
Why would you do this?
I put you on the spot.
You did.
And I made fools of both of us.
Yep. And then Dave makes fools of us all with his ringtone.
Oh, he was in Little Miss Sunshine.
Yep.
And he's in There Will Be Blood. He's in 12 Years a Slave.
Huh.
He's in Okja. He's in Swiss Army Man.
Yep. He's been in a ton of stuff.
When I saw his picture... He's in Looper. I've seen Looper.
I've seen 12 Years a Slave. I've seen There Will Be Blood. I don't know who this guy is.
He's also in Cowboys and Aliens, if that helps you.
He is a...
Nope.
We saw Cowboys...
I've seen it, but I don't remember who he is.
He's one of those character actors.
Okay. All right.
So I think it's just kind of interesting that they're doing Riddler. In a way I feel that's almost bad, because I kind of like the Riddler when he's a lighter weight Batman enemy, but like he was like, you know, sometimes he's like almost like an organized killer supervillain in a weird way in Year Zero that Snyder did.
Yeah.
And I guess it's going to be like, well, he was also like a killer in Gotham, too.
Well, I hope he can live up to the portrayal of Jim Carrey.
They'll go the complete opposite. They're going to do the Arkham Knight version, where he's the Saw kind of guy, probably.
I guess I never played that.
Where he's like, but it's not necessarily like murderous, he's more of like a trickster type guy.
Yeah, but even that, there were like, he was putting people in harm's way through his traps stuff.
I could kind of go with that. I know, in a way, that sort of seems like a decent idea for an update of it to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll see. I'm not 100% on board this Batman.
I am also not 100% on board. The only thing that I've been excited about is Zoe Kravitz being Catwoman.
Yeah, I think that's good.
Other than that, I think I'm mostly not on board. Sticking with Batman, though, they've announced Batman 86 and 87, which are coming out in January 2020. Batman 86 and 87.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Number 86 and 87.
Basically, after Tom King finishes up his Bane story.
Because of the common use of the word, of the phrase, Batman 89, and I'm like, what is Batman 86 and Batman 87?
Those two secret movies that came out that we never saw.
It's the Gotham. It's Batman before he becomes Batman, Bruce Wayne in 86.
So we're just talking about who's taken over after Tom King.
Yeah,
right?
So they put out the solicits, they put out the covers. Apparently, Deathstroke, Cheshire, and Merlin are coming after Batman. So, Dave, it's full of assassins.
Hmm. Mm. I'll tell you this. I guess when I'm reading superhero fare, I don't mind assassins in various roles. It's just movies about assassins that are just like... Oh my god.
Speaking of movies about assassins.
Wait, hang on. I got to stick on the Batman thing.
I like the villain trio. I Cheshire is a good character.
And the Riddler is named in the second one, so apparently he's going to be in there in some big role.
I hope he's a serial killer. Tinian is not, I think, is he a writer that any of us, like, seek out?
No, but you guys all like Something is Killing the Children?
It's true, yep. We do. And I've liked Tim Varis. He's worked with Scott Snyder a lot.
And you got a fancy hardcover of his detective run.
I did, yes.
Yeah. So his detective run was one, the recent one from Rebirth.
Yep.
That it was an ensemble cast of sort of Batman allies led by Batwoman, but also featuring Tim Drake.
Stephanie Brown.
Orphan.
Clayface, kind of on a redemption arc.
Which actually worked better than you would have thought.
Yeah, and some really nice artwork. Something is Killing the Children, his book for, who does that?
Boom.
For Boom, is actually quite exceptional, I think. The weird thing is, to me, this looks like a back-to-basics thing. They're like, we know Tom King was weird. We're going to have some punching going on now.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's what people want from a flagship Batman book. I think they may want a more cutting-edge Batman book.
I agree.
But I really liked his detective run. So for me, at least, this probably makes me a little bit more interested than I would have had, with, like, Snyder or King on board.
I think it's potentially a misstep for exactly the reason you know. I think Snyder's run and King's run, while not my thing in general, both of them did big things. Snyder really redefined Batman. It was must reading. King was must reading Batman.
So they should have brought in their version of Hickman.
This is going to feel like another ongoing detective series. It's not going to feel like it doesn't feel like a flagship move.
There will probably be less horse killings.
There will be less horse killings.
I do wonder, though, if it's... we know that Tinian is pretty prolific.
Yeah.
And I wonder if he is essentially, because the Tom King thing fell apart, is going to be a fill-in. Like, he comes in, not like a short thing, but maybe for 15 or 20 issues.
Yeah.
And then they come back in with somebody who's like a big-time A-lister, auteur.
Brian Bendis takes over Batman.
All right, Nick, just don't even say those things. We don't need to accidentally summon something.
What about Batman and Legion of Superheroes?
I mean, probably it's going to happen.
I believe Batman Beyond is in Legion of Superheroes.
What if Comet the Superhorse comes in before Tom King's run and Batman kills him?
What if Comet the Superhorse is actually Batman?
Ah, interesting.
I'll be super sad. I don't know, Nick, are you going to... I'm sure try it
it's
out.
It's Batman. Tinian is a writer who's proved himself. I'm going to read it.
Do they have an artist on it?
Yes.
And who is that artist, and where do I know them from?
Tony Daniel.
Oh. Tony Daniel is better.
I was going to say, it sounds really bad to say he has gotten better over the years. I'm just saying,
the pitch can't be, hey, here's this writer who sometimes we like, and an artist who's gotten better. That's not your best foot forward with A-list Batman.
Yeah, I think Tony Daniel has a style that will appeal to people, that is within close enough to the ballpark of Jim Lee, that I actually think that, like, had he been coupled with, say Jonathan Hickman was coming over to do Batman right now, while he's white hot from X-Men stuff, I think that he would be an asset to the book, not to me personally, but I think he's a commercial. I think he can be commercial.
Yeah, I agree.
He's also he's worked on Batman before. He worked with
Grant Morrison,
and he also did work with Tom King as well.
And he wrote and drew Detective, where Joker got his face cut off.
Why would you make me remember that? That was horrible.
Is he doing that with, was it Finch drawing it?
No, he drew it.
That was him?
No,
okay.
He wrote and drew it. He was responsible for that.
Wait. Was that Tony Daniel or was that David Finch? I mixed it.
No, I think that was Tony Daniel. Okay. I think you're right.
If that's the case, then at least we're lucky he's not writing it.
Yes.
all right, Randy, you were saying, what were you about to segue into?
I was segueing into assassin movies.
All right, hit it.
Because Valiant has their first movie. Not that you'd know it from their name being mentioned anywhere in the trailer.
Right, not from like the graphic novel series.
Nope. It is Bloodshot, starring Vin Diesel. And it seems to have been turned into a very generic Vin Diesel action movie.
Did they not Valiant? Did they not say Valiant anywhere?
Nowhere on that trailer.
But they do say it's like from the comic.
From the graphic novel. Yeah, but they don't mention Valiant at all.
They do mention that.
That's weird.
You're sure they didn't have like the Valiant V or something like that?
Yeah, there's nothing on there.
I watched this morning after hearing from Dave. He was like, it looks solid.
Right, well, so just a quick let y'all know, we have a running thread on Facebook where we just... drop in any links to news and topics that we want to talk about. So Randy and I both simultaneously posted links to this trailer.
We both watched it at the same time, and then we both posted the link.
Yeah, and I was like, looks pretty decent. And Randy was like, this looks terrible. Doesn't that sound like Randy?
Yes. Yes,
and I watched it, and I was more into on Dave's side of things.
I think Dave's not wrong, though. I think it looks like a decent generic action movie.
Well, here's the thing. I don't actually think it looks generic, like, as a concept. Like, it's if you said generic action sci-fi, but Vin Diesel doesn't even... I mean, like, what action sci-fi has he done that's not XXX? Not XXX.
Pitch Black.
Pitch Black. I mean, there probably is something.
Probably.
He did that fantasy... The Last Witch Hunter.
Yeah.
He also did that Babylon AD movie that's sort of futuristic sci-fi.
Right.
One just went under my radar.
But he has not done something that's sort of in his Fast and Furious wheelhouse, but with a sci-fi twist.
Right. And that's kind of what this is. I feel like it might appeal to them.
Maybe. The concept of, like, they're basically erasing his memory, giving him this false backstory that his wife was murdered, and filling in the guy who murdered her so that he goes rogue and goes and kills the guy, even though he's fulfilling orders. It's an interesting pitch.
Isn't that basically the pitch for the first series when Valiant brought it back?
Similar to, yeah.
It's interesting that they kind of did what is sort of the big reveal in the trailer.
Yeah.
But I do think you kind of needed that. Otherwise, it did look a little generic.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing is, like, he is not some regular guy. He, like, Cap is a super soldier type person, and that does mean that we've... You know, a lot of the Marvel movies have people at about the level he's operating at. Pretty, you know, five times as good as a human.
Instead of super serum that Cap has, he has
nanites.
He has little nanobots in his body.
Warren Ellis is like, I wrote that 20 years ago.
I created the nanites.
I am the creator of nanites as a fictional concept.
I have to admit, I think part of this is that I want this to be Valiant's big coming out party. I like Valiant's universe. I would really have liked this to be their movie, and it is not Blair Blanchard.
Right. It feels like in the same way, almost the way Marvel movies in the late 90s, early 2000s were, where they're like, well, we're going to kind of disguise it a little bit. Yeah. The X-Men are going to look like they're kind of action heroes in, like, you know, black jumpsuits and stuff like that. They're not going to look like superheroes. They're not going to use their powers too much.
Yeah, because Bloodshot has a cool look. Bloodshot has that pure white look with the red...
Well, they are going to use that because they actually created an action figure for it that looks horrific.
It's only an action figure. Like, it's not in the movie anywhere.
Well, that could be one of the, even though this trailer felt like it gave away a lot, I feel like it could be showing what's really just like the first half hour or something of it, and kind of like holding out to reveal him in full Bloodshot mode for either later trailers or for the movie itself.
I think this is going to be a stealth Valiant universe, and they'll throw in Ninjak and
Faith is going to have a walk-on role, and
I would be up for that. Archer and Armstrong as well.
That's what I want, and I don't feel like I'm going to get it.
I didn't even look to see who's directing this. I thought Guy Pearce was hamming it up like crazy.
I forgot Guy Pearce was in it.
Yeah, he's basically like the CIA or whatever handler guy that's creating the false.
What's the song that they play from Johnny Cash?
It's
memories are made of this or something. Like, that's the refrain, song. But I don't know what it's. Yeah. Maybe that's the name and maybe it's not. But it is a good song, and. It's interesting because I was watching when our staffer Anna watched the trailer. I was just kind of watching her and listening to it. And she was a little puzzled. She's like, interesting choice of a song for the trailer or whatever. Yep. And I don't think she realized that, of course, the song has a relevance and gets repeated as a reference to his kind of like continual brainwashing.
I thought it looked polished for an action flick. So,
yeah.
It's going to do well. People will flock to see Vin Diesel regardless.
We'll see.
I know. He does have, like, his witch hunters.
Yeah.
But this looks like, more satisfying
did that,
than
did that. Did
that
turn into, like, a cult hit? Or, like,
I don't
like
know.
To, like, D&D fans? I don't know.
Think
maybe, okay. I didn't care for it. But.
The last story we have here is kind of a one I think we saw coming, basically. According to Variety, Jeff Loeb is going to be leaving Marvel's as head of their television division. Says he is in the market for an exclusive deal with Outside Studios as a producer. And I'm like, yeah, I bet you are.
Maybe he can get a job at Valiant. On their branding. You as much as Gester said this last week, that he's on his way out because Kevin Feige was kind of taking over that role, right?
Yep. And it's interesting because also this feels like maneuvering. Jeff Loeb reported, he worked with Dan Buckley, who was the publisher and is now the president of Marvel, and he reported to Ike Perlmutter, who is the vampire who runs the company.
Right.
And it sounds like Perlmutter and Feige never really got along, and Feige managed to sort of carve himself a domain away from him.
Yeah.
And Loeb, I think, was on the inside, and it's basically a little bit of that corporate office war thing that happens.
Yeah.
So, you know, I am okay with this. I generally think Loeb has been a bad thing for Marvel TV. I think he's not the world's greatest comic writer.
But I bet we see him come back to comics now.
Maybe. I mean, whatever.
Nick, if you could, because I know that you and I in particular probably have liked Loeb's, some of his projects more than Randy has, although I bet Randy has a decent selection of them on his shelf.
Yeah, ranging from the color ones from Marvel.
Do you have Long Halloween?
I do have Long Halloween.
I'm weirdly going to say I would prefer him at DC. I think he works better at DC with those characters.
Right, we know he's got some weird Silver Age sensibilities. I sort of liked his insane, sometimes Silver Age, sometimes a little more gritty Red Hulk run. But that was bizarre. That was truly
that was like
strange
Hulk,
stuff.
Red Hulk punching out the Watcher and yeah. very kind of...
He was definitely letting his artists, who were like a treasure trove of really good artists, Ed McGuinness, Frank Cho, I forget who all else was on there, but they were like all good artists.
Well, by all reports, that's kind of why people like working with Loeb, is that he is a, well, what do you want to draw? And then he works right. into a story, which right. is a very Hollywood-y thing.
Right. Also does not lead to the, like, tightest, most thoughtful stories. It sometimes means you're the bonkers guy.
What I would like is I would like him to do stuff that's out of continuity.
Yeah.
I would like him, I mean, I'd like to work with Jim Sale because the two of them work really well together, but I would like him to do stories that don't have to interface with continuity. Stuff like Red Hulk and Batman Hush, which I know is beloved, and some of the other stuff he's done that's like in continuity. I know there's another big one at DC I'm forgetting. He did Batman Superman.
I was going to say, his Batman Superman.
I wonder, since he has at times exhibited darker tendencies in his work, do you think he'll end up with some Black Label project with Tim Sale?
I'd be okay with that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Tim Sale, a Black Label with Loeb and Sale, I'd read that.
If nothing else, it would look good.
Yeah.
Yep.
Sale's always talented on that level. Yeah.
So we'll see. All right. That's it for news. We'll be back in just a second to talk about comics for the week. We're talking comics for the week of October 23rd, and the big news, as always, is another X-Men book.
Yes.
That's the heat, the hotness is on the X-Men books right now. So let's just jump right into that, Nick.
Okay.
Because we know it's going to be your pick.
Yes, it is.
So, I actually like this one, too.
You're hearing stunned...
or at least I didn't hate it, which for me is
that, that's
good.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's that. This issue is Marauders number one, which is...
Not written by Hickman, and maybe that's why Randy felt more comfortable with it.
No, but this is written by Jerry Dugan. Art by... Why am I blanking... It's Matteo Lolli.
Matteo Lolli.
Which it's really nice art.
It is.
And this one focuses on Kitty Pryde.
I like Kitty Pryde.
I like Kitty Pryde as well.
She was the lead of X-Men Gold, the book I really liked. They killed the big way for
her. She does sort of build her crew.
Well, the big thing is about...
Sort of a literal crew.
I think on page one, it's laid out that she can't use the gates that lead to Krakoa.
Right, which is to say they're glowing portals from Krakoa seeds or whatever?
Yes, they're Krakoa flowers.
Right, and right now it's a mystery, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, we don't know why she can't travel through them.
I think if it was as simple as, like, her phasing power just disrupts it or something like that, they would have said it. So there must be some...
It could be something like that.
But there's got to be some deeper meaning. Well, maybe it was just to, like...
So she has to get to Krakoa some way.
Yeah.
So she steals a boat.
Why did she steal a boat? I feel like Kitty Pryde probably has assets where she could get to a boat. Okay.
I mean, she was probably stuck in one place, and I guess she could have flown there with an X-Jet or something.
Yeah.
But they want to go the pirate route, so she has a boat. Mm-hmm. She has her friend Lockheed. And I want to say, while this is sort of a lighter book, I mean, there's definitely big stories and kind of through lines that are going through it. There is sort of a lightness to this, and I appreciated that.
Yeah.
There's a jokiness that she's, like, delivering goods to Krakoa, especially to Logan.
Right. I think we can say that, like there's actually, like, a full list of what he requested from her, but you might be not surprised to know that he's like, I need booze on this island.
Yeah.
And that's part of the deal.
But there's also sort of... Emma Frost and Kitty Pryde and how they get along.
Right.
Their sort of relationship. I actually think the team in this one is pretty interesting. It's an interesting group of characters.
We can say that the team is, right?
I mean, it's Storm, who is just Kitty's, one of Kitty's best friends.
Mm-hmm.
Iceman, who is the jokester of the group in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
But he's also a force to be reckoned with. Then there's Lockheed, of course.
I'm glad to see Lockheed back. He's been kind of... I don't even know if he's around in X-Men Gold. Like, he feels like he's been off screen for a while.
Yeah, and I like this version of Lockheed where he's basically just a dragon. I don't need him to be like some...
I never liked Alan Davis's talking dragon thing. I liked him being an animal.
I like that he's just grabbing sushi and fish.
There was a funny bit where Kitty was like, I guess that's why there weren't any rats.
Or squirrels.
Xavier's, he was eating all of them. I'm like, that's pretty funny.
Also, Bishop, it looks like.
Yeah. What was Bishop out doing?
Bishop is actually
he's in China, right?
Yeah, he's like investigator. Like he's kind of. It reminds me a lot of what they were doing with Mutant Town?
Mutant Town, yeah.
M-Town, where he was sort of the cop.
I like that role.
Yeah,
I like this role for him.
Well, then they made him a bad guy, and that was stupid.
That's dumb.
And this feels more Bishop again.
But now all the bad guys are good guys. Apocalypse and Magneto are all part of the team.
And speaking of bad guys,
we have Pyro.
The original Pyro, I guess he'd been replaced at some point.
Well, I believe he was actually one of the first individuals to die from the Legacy virus.
That's correct.
Okay. Yeah, but because of their weird resurrection technology of Krakoa has been returning.
Do you think Mr. Sinister's like really upset about the Krakoa virus, about the Legacy virus? He undid all his good work with the Legacy virus?
Yeah, probably.
I mean,
did they address that at all?
They haven't mentioned it.
I know Mr. Sinister is also
he's like,
a good guy.
I killed
now.
Off so many mutants, and now they're back?
Sinister is good, but no one trusts Sinister.
His name is Mr. Sinister.
Yeah.
I could change him.
But Randy made a good point that Pyro is essentially Captain Boomerang from
DC Universe. They dialed up his Australian. He's on the team because he fell asleep on the boat while he was trying to steal it.
Doesn't he use the term Yabo?
He does use the term Yabo.
Very Australian, which is cool. But the cool thing is they get their moments. All these characters get sort of their fun moments, their action-oriented moments. Kitty Pryde gets to be a badass.
Yeah, and
like, have we said like what the sort of mission statement of the book is?
No.
Like what they're doing?
We shouldn't spoil it.
I don't want to spoil that because
I wasn't sure if it was just like being discussed.
I actually thought the premise was going to be completely different than what it actually is.
I agree. The reveal of the premise is really good, and actually is one of the things that made me like it. I like the reason for the book.
But Kitty Pryde is an awesome character, and she's powerful, and she's the leader of the frickin' X-Men. She's been that, and this kind of shows that. And I also say Pyro gets a badass moment with the action sequence.
Yep.
So I loved it. I'm a little weirded out that the Kitty Pryde chooses the name Marauders. Just because it's got some weird connotations
as
with X-Men.
Storm.
And they do bring it up in the story.
They do address it. But I'm really looking forward to see where this story goes. And there's even from House of X and Powers of X, Sinister is basically the gossip news that Sinister has.
It's like mutant gossip.
It is. It's basically...
Should he change his name to Mr. Sassy now that he is?
He is Sassy Sinister. But yeah, there's some more of those revealed, which lead to some interesting stuff for other books. So I'm curious to see where things go.
You know what? That kind of approach reminds me of when DC did the 52 weekly series, and they had who was it? Not Rip Hunter's the whiteboard that he had in his office.
Yeah, and it was all sort of like the interconnected.
Right, he had like the mad scrawlings of this time traveler, but in fact, a lot of it was like hinting at storylines to come and things that would only become contextualized later. So yeah, Sinister
has a tabloid essentially.
Yeah, he's got kind of his gossip rag, which he doesn't always name names in it, but it's like hints at what's going on elsewhere.
So. He's the Rich Johnson of Krakoa.
Sure.
Reference it. No one who's not on the internet will understand.
Yeah, I was going to say like some other famous gossip columnist, but I couldn't think of one. Liz Smith, is that one?
Sure, it might be.
I think so.
But yes, Seek Out Marauders, it was a lot of fun.
So my pick is also a number one. It is a book from Dark Horse called Count Crowley, Reluctant Midnight Monster Hunter. The first we heard of this was we got a poster from Dark Horse this week that's signed by like the writer and the artist, and we're like, we don't know any of these names. why do we care that this is signed? Turns out the writer, David Dastmalchian, is the guy who played the Russian in Ant-Man, in the Ant-Man sequel.
And is presumably a comics guy.
And has been in, he's going to be in Dune, he's done a bunch of stuff. And presumably he's a comics guy. He wrote this thing. Art is by Lucas Kettner, who I don't know, but man, the art is great.
Yeah, it's really good.
It's got a, how would you compare this to, Dave? It's,
I mean, it looks a little, like, just at a quick glance, upside down, yeah. It looks a little like Francesco Francavilla's Afterlife with Archie art.
Yeah, he's definitely riffing on EC Comics a little bit.
But there's also some of those, like, I want to say, like, almost like Steve Lieber.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, it's...
When he's kind of doing his slightly more humor-oriented stuff.
I was thinking, like, Steve Plug and some of those, or Mike Plug and some of those guys.
Yeah, yeah.
He's sort of... A little
more, 70s, like, more cartoony.
70s horror cartoony guys, yeah. Yeah. So basically, this woman who is a she's on a news show. She's drunk. She tells the truth to her viewers, which gets her fired. Her brother like runs the station, so he gives her one last chance, basically filling in for Count Crowley, who is like their Elvira, their yeah. uncle vampire, the guy who's like their late night movie host, bad movies, and she gets all made up. As her own version of Count Crowley, and she makes fun of it all, and she starts, you know, basically introducing Jesse James versus the Wolfman, I think is the movie.
Yep.
And this all seems like it's an interesting sort of slice of life story, and then at the very end, she's approached by a guy who is a werewolf, who Count Crowley promised to help him, and it seems like maybe Count Crowley was actually doing actual monster work on the side. And that's where it leads. Like, we don't know where it's going to go from there, but it's a fun premise.
It's a little. It's very much Fright Night.
I was going to say it's kind of Fright Night,
Or the backstory of it. Like Fright Night was sort of also a my new neighbor is a vampire.
Yeah.
But the backstory that has the TV, the horror host who is actually, well, at least someone thinks is a real monster hunter.
Yeah.
Because Charlie might not be the brightest of bulbs.
This one, it might turn out that the host actually was a monster.
Right.
Yeah. I like the character quite a bit. I'm interested in seeing where that goes, and it's a fun premise, and it's really nice art. Dave, what about your pick?
All right, my pick is a callback to something that honestly we've talked up so much before that I don't have a ton extra to say about it. But the graphic novel trade paperback of Spider-Man Life Story is today, and I was very enamored of this, and so I want to pick that as my pick.
Well, I feel like this is going to wind up on all our best of lists.
Yeah. This is, so just as a real quick recap, in case you don't remember the deal, this is a miniseries from the last year, was it 6 issues?
Yes.
Yep.
That Chip Zdarsky wrote, Mark Bagley drew, and told the story of Spider-Man's full life, really, beginning in the 60s, and as if he was bitten by Spider in the year that the character was created. And then would proceed to age normally.
Mm-hmm.
So you see the ups and downs of his entire life. You see all the sort of famous foes and like big events of like you kind of somewhat know or that you know pretty well probably from Spider-Man's history. Whether it's Green Goblin going after Gwen Stacy, the original Clone Saga, the rise of Venom, all that kind of stuff. Even Miles Morales. But because he ages in sort of real time through this, not only does he interacts more with the events, the politics and things that are running through the era, starting with Vietnam in the 60s, you also, he's at interesting ages when these things happen. He's like in his 40s or 50s when Venom comes up, and it's like, how do you deal with that? And everything is really thoughtfully done. It's super, super smart. It's got a lot of heart. It's dark at times. Even once or twice I was like, this is a little darker than I'd like. But I felt like always there was that sense of, it was dark the way, in some ways, that old Spider-Man comics could be, where there is a bit of a silver lining on the horizon, and it's not morose. Just a little gloomy once or twice.
Yeah.
It's not dark like Deceased. It's
No. It is not a wreck you forever sort of thing. Anyway, there's endless great moments in this. You know, whether it's like Peter Parker going to Captain America to ask him what the right thing to do about Vietnam is, how he interacts with his family. There's ups and downs with Mary Jane that I thought were really good and really interesting and sort of spoke to kind of real relationships in a way that's hard to do in a comic that's serialized over decades. But when you kind of go back on it with hindsight 2020 and you kind of try to imagine, oh, what would happen if they got married? Would it work out? Would it not work out? And there's also some really good twists in it. Like, the last issue had several cool twists that were all super satisfying. So I got nothing but good stuff to say about this. There's some in the back. It's got, you know, all the covers collected, a little bit of behind the scenes stuff, and some variant covers, some notes from Chip Zdarsky. And I'm not 100% sure about this, but I was under the impression that that he was maybe going to fill out a few extra pages in this to make the story flow better as a graphic novel. I'll have to read the full thing before I'm sure of that, but I seem to remember that was part of that was maybe in the solicit or maybe just in interviews with Chip Zdarsky. Anyway, definitely my favorite Spider-Man thing I've read in the last several years, so I highly recommend Spider-Man Life Story.
Dave, what else is on your stack?
Let's see. Okay, one book that we didn't get enough of that I almost shouldn't even mention it, but maybe we'll get some more of it. It's a book with the provocative title of Money Shot. This is written by Tim Seeley, who people may know from Hack Slash, or he worked on the Grayson comic. He's working here with Sarah Beatty? I don't know how you say her name. But this is a sort of a messed up sci-fi sex romp. Essentially what it suggests is that in the near future, like maybe about a little over 10, 15 years in the future, a group of scientists, recognizing that science as an interest is stagnating in the future, and that the science is on the outs with the current presidential administration. I don't know how they would extrapolate this, but it's an idea that they have. Takes to making porn movies with aliens in order to fund their ventures. So it is, in fact, the scientists making porn movies.
Okay, sure.
Now, with aliens. They are trying to do actual sort of research while they're doing it. This is a kind of tongue-in-cheek book, as you might guess. And it's drawn in a style of, for people who like Amanda Conner's artwork, and I know we've got a decent Amanda Conner following at the store.
Yep.
I feel like this art from Rebecca Isaacs reflects sort of those sensibilities. Really appealing character design, great expressions, good backgrounds and all of that stuff. And this is pretty funny, too. It's like dirty funny, but it's pretty good. So I cannot quite tell what they're going to be doing with this series overall. Don't share it with your kids, but that's recommended. Amazing Spider-Man Full Circle. I didn't give this a full read, but it has the craziest premise. Randy, yeah. I think you've read it, so why don't you, do you want to pick
I didn't get through all of it either, because it's a big, giant trade, or a big giant issue. It's like 10 bucks. It's got a ton of creators, but here's the deal. Seven teams of Marvel's most creative contributors crafting an all-new adventure of the Spider-Man in round-robin style, with each successive creative team picking up the story before the previous creators left off. No roadmap, no contact, no plan, just a whole lot of prayer. And then everyone's scrambling together in the final chapter to try to bring the whole story together successfully. So it's Jonathan Hickman, Jerry Duggan, Nick Spencer, Kelly Thompson, Al Ewing, Chip Zdarsky, and Jason Aaron.
Some of the biggest writers at Marvel right now.
The artists include Chris Bacallo, Greg Smallwood, Michael Allred, Valerio Schiti, Chris Sprouse, Mark Bagley, Cameron Stewart. And it opens with... So I didn't read the first page that tells the premise.
Yeah, you just thought that this was like a collection of Spider-Man stories.
I thought it was going to be a collection of Spider-Man. So I open it, and it's like Nick Fury with Spider-Man in the black costume. They're in a space station, and a few pages in, he gets ejected out into space, and then Spider-Ham, a hallucinogenic Spider-Ham, shows up, and I was like, what is going on? And as I kept reading it...
stranger from there?
They land in some weird Disney World type thing. There's AIM troops... Werewolves show up, Spider-Man becomes a werewolf, everyone becomes a werewolf. It is crazy. Then several Spider-Hams show up. It's a bonkers story. I'm like, oh, now that I know this was all done in like round robin style, it makes a lot more sense. And it's, if you enjoy the sort of things like, if you enjoy Tumblr, if you enjoy those out of context comic panels, and I know a lot of people do, this is a whole comic basically made up of that, just a kind of wackiness.
I also think it's kind of funny in what I read, that vibe you get that the writers, that they were supposed to create some subplots and things like that so the other subsequent writers could, pay off some of them while still keeping others going.
Yeah.
You kind of feel like they were trolling, whoever's next, I'm going to give him something really messed up he's got to try and write his way out of.
And at the back of the issue, there is a...
It's like a series of emails or texts.
Yeah, it's basically an email thread with all the writers.
Trying to figure out this chaos, yes. Which is pretty funny in its own right.
Yeah.
I think Jonathan Hickman is like, what the hell has this become?
Yeah. It definitely feels like the kind of thing where the writers are going to tell the story at conventions a few years, but like, I can't believe they let us publish this.
The only other book I was just going to mention is, or maybe one or two more, they did one of their Year of the Villain books with Black Adam featured there. And I think that actually might be it as far as stuff I wanted to make sure to mention.
Okay. Yeah. Ghost Spider number 3, which I've been really enjoying, is in our third issue. Second Coming number 4, which is the Jesus comes to Earth to learn superheroing from a Superman type. It continues to be really funny. Mark Russell has a gift with, and he introduces his version of Batman here, which is pretty funny. And they go looking for Jesus. He bursts into this like superhero support group where they're talking about how inferior they all feel to the Superman type, and he pops in, and he's like, "Yeah, I need your help." He's like, "I need you to help me find Jesus." Not literally speaking, not figuratively. And that's been pretty fun. Journey to Star Wars, Rise of Skywalker, the prequel to that, since its third issue. There's a new Amazing Mary Jane, which is a Mary Jane miniseries. And then Immortal Hulk number 25 starts a new sort of cosmic theme storyline. So a pretty new direction for that book. Also want to mention a couple trades. Star Wars Galaxy's Edge trade, which is the introduction of the theme park and has some fun characters. And this thing, Star Wars Creatures Big and Small, a Galactic Basic Edition, which has art by Katie Cook, and is basically fun poems and cute artwork of all the various creatures in the Star Wars universe, from the Han Solo movie to the current movies to the prequels to everybody. So,
yeah, I feel like kids who were getting like
the Darth Vader dad and all that stuff.
Yeah. If your kids were liking those, this would be an easy fit in with the
Nick.
With
what else?
I only have one other book that I wanted to mention, which is Jane Foster Valkyrie number 4.
Oh, I forgot to read that. I've been enjoying that series.
Sees Jane Foster run across people like Grim Reaper and Mephisto.
Interesting.
So
Grim Reaper is a... I'm not going to say that he's not used too often, but I think it's somewhat infrequent. He's a weird old villain.
Yep.
He got a scythe hand.
He is...
something to do with Simon Williams.
He's his brother.
It's his brother.
Yeah, his brother.
And he hates...
it's rough when your brother is a supervillain with a scythe hand named the Grim Reaper.
It is true.
And also, but we can all relate, I think.
And also, weirdly, some related to Vision and all that craziness.
Right.
Yeah.
If you're related to Wonder Man, you're related to Vision.
It's true. And craziness.
But
how is his use in this?
He is... I mean, I don't want to spoil it too much, because he is kind of integral to the issue. Mm-hmm. But it continues to be good. We get some downtime with Jane and her roommate... dealing with the idea that the Valkyrie's horse is now lives with them in the apartment.
Sure.
Well, he won't go. He won't go.
Come
home.
And take it, Batman.
He won't go home because, he's a war horse.
He can't fit out the window.
Well, there's that too.
So Batman lurks outside with a gun.
There's just also a bunch
horse
of
to come outside.
There's also another big kind of tie to the Marvel universe, but I really like the series. It's good. More people should be checking it out
for sure.
All right. Well, that takes care of comics for us. Back in just a second, talk about some TV and movies and games. So before we get into the topics at hand, we real quick want to check in on Halloween month. As I'm watching, I think we're all watching horror movies and Halloween movies. I caught... I don't know, this doesn't quite count, but I caught Addams Family, the new animated one.
That counts in,
it's
like,
spooky.
It's what they call spoopy.
And altogether, ooky.
Yes.
So it's got a great voice cast. It looks really nice. It is okay.
Yeah.
I would say exactly okay. Like, I based on the trailers, I thought, oh, this could be terrible. But I got my Aloha Pass. I wanted to use it.
Yep.
So I went. My first use of the Aloha Pass was to go see the Addams Family. And it is exactly okay. It is actually more of a kid-friendly take on the Addams Family. I think that, like, if you have kids who have a little bit of gothy in them but don't want actual scares, it's got a nice message about, you know, Pugsley having to do his, like, whatever they call the scimitar dance thing.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he's no good with it, but he's good with explosives, and it's about sort of his dad learning to accept him and not tradition. It's Snoop Dogg plays Cousin It. Like, there's some fun bits in it. Yeah. Allison Janney plays a, like, she has a perfect neighborhood. She's like one of these makeover moms. And
homeowners association type.
Yeah, well, it's like a reality TV show.
Oh, I see.
And she has this whole neighborhood, and then the fog lifts, and they discover the Addams Family is like dead center camera, and they actually has to deal with them. And it sort of is about gentrification and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So it's got some messages. It's cute. It's not like there's a couple things I got chuckles out of. There's a lot of unnecessary pop culture references, like you get in a lot of these things.
Mm-hmm.
I would say it was better than I expected to be. And I think if you have kids, I would definitely recommend it. If, however, you're like, oh, I love the Barry Sonnenfeld movies, I can't wait to see more of that, this is only going to disappoint you. But it was fun enough. And then I watched Happy Death Day to You, which is the sequel to Happy Death Day.
Or Happy Death Day 2.
No, it's to You.
To You.
Is it?
Yeah. Did you not know this?
No, I don't think I ever noticed that.
Happy Death Day to You.
Oh, with a number two?
And a U.
Very clever. All right, pray continue, sir.
So, this is the one I liked but didn't love, Happy Death Day, and I felt the same about Happy Death Day to You. I feel like they're about on the same level for me. This one gets into more of the, why is she reincarnating? And it started off with this other character dying and reincarnating, and I'm like, oh, this is going to be fun.
Yeah.
And then, nope, it's still her reincarnated, and it's all about her mom. And they introduced the notion of, like, alternate dimensions, and I'm like, oh, it's going to get crazy. And it didn't. It was just her against the serial killer again. So it was good,
yeah.
But it had potential to be so much more, and I was kind of disappointed that it wasn't so much more. But it's on HBO, and it's worth a watch.
Sounds about right.
Dave, you're not going to spoil anything because I'm going to go see it tomorrow, but yep. You saw Zombieland Double Tap.
Yep. I just kind of wanted to sort of chime in and recommend Zombieland Double Tap for anyone who enjoyed the first movie. I feel that for me, like, I don't want to overhype it, but I feel it was actually a little bit funnier to me than the first one. Very similar vibe to it. You know, the humor's all the same, the characters are all there, and it's certainly, if you like the first one, I guarantee you're going to like the second one. There's, you know, a few new characters and some new dynamics that are thrown in there. A friend hypothesized that the failed TV show, which only ever produced a pilot.
A terrible pilot.
Oh, was it?
Oh, it's god-awful.
But his guess was that they folded what would have been plot elements from, like, that whole first season. They kind of cherry-picked it, and they used that for the movie.
Well, because Zombieland was really supposed to be a TV show.
Oh, that's right.
It was originally going to be that. They pitched it as a TV show. It wound up becoming a movie. And then Amazon Prime did a TV show.
Mm-hmm.
But at that point, it had been established as Jesse Eisenberg and Woody Harrelson. And there also ran people that they had in their cast were just enough to task. Also, the writing was not as good. I have one question.
Yes.
It's not a spoilery question, but does the Zombie Kill of the Week make an appearance in this? Because that was a thing they were going to do every episode.
It does.
Okay, good. I'm excited about
it. It does. And I thought also, like, in particular, I, like, really liked the opening to it. Like, I always like when a movie that's got some humor to it gets off on a good foot.
Yeah.
I feel like it gets off on a good foot.
Well, do you remember, I was started rewatching Zombieland last night before I go see it.
Yep.
Do you remember the opening of Zombieland?
No.
It's a sort of slow motion thing for whom the bell tolls by Metallica.
Oh.
That sort of shows a bunch of zombies attacking. Like, there's this hilarious bit where there's a businessman running with fistfuls of dollars as a topless zombie stripper chases after him.
Yes.
There's a zombie on fire, like, running at a firefighter, and it's all sort of like almost like what Zack Snyder did with the opening of Watchmen, where it's like moving pictures.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's very effective, and it really gets you into the mode of Zombieland really
quickly. Yeah, and I think they do something different, but equally fun in this. Was there anything else I was going to mention? I've got one or two criticisms, and I guess you could argue that maybe, like, the plot is a little bounces around, but it does definitely have a coherent narrative in it that's... that you're around, but if it was made up of, like, multiple, you know, like, episodes kind of strung together, mm-hmm. I could sort of see it. What I actually kind of liked about that is it felt a little unpredictable. Like, you know, sometimes you can, like, see a movie and you're like, well, I'm going to enjoy this, but I can see what the arcs are.
Right.
It was a little bit harder to see in this one.
Well, that's good.
And that was kind of fun. So, anyway, definitely go check it out.
We'll probably talk about it more in detail next week after I've seen
it.
Yeah,
we'll do a breakdown.
You know what's interesting is it's been, like, 10 years since Zombieland came out. Like, it's a long time between
absolutely.
Movies.
Absolutely.
And then, Nick, you just rewatched.
Yeah, basically, it's on Netflix. I kind of felt the need to rewatch it because it's probably one of my favorite horror movies that's been made the past decade.
Mm-hmm. What is that?
It is The Conjuring, which is...
I got introduced to by you guys and really liked.
Yeah.
Conjuring and Conjuring 2 are both very
worthy. Both really good.
Both very good. I still think the first one is the best, even though I think the second one definitely has its moments.
You know, I really liked The Conjuring, but I think I've only seen it once.
Same. And I mix up the 1 and 2 because I watched them pretty much back to back.
Well, and it was like the introduction to the Warrens and sort of this large tapestry of movies that now fit into it.
Yeah.
Right, I believe the opening sequence has them dealing with Annabelle.
It is. I completely forgot that.
Would go on to become like its own separate franchise, which I think you kind of like okay, and I kind of mostly hate. But I did like Annabelle Comes Home, so they somehow got a ride on the third one for me.
Annabelle Comes Home is great.
But yeah, it's when I remember when I was first watching it, it was a creepy opening. Like, it's eerie.
Yeah. Well, and also they set up a lot of stuff that they go back to in like the other movies, like in Annabelle Comes Home, you know, the, weird, like, Japanese armor.
Yeah.
It's in the very first
shot. Oh man, I didn't remember that. That's kind of cool.
Yeah. And it's just lots of payoff here and there, but it's just a really good story.
I like
creepy as hell.
The two leads are great in that.
Yep.
And, Nick, where does it take place, that first one?
Rhode Island.
Rhode Island, okay.
Yep. Small farm, or not a small farm, it's actually a rather large farm, inhabited once by a witch.
I think we would say, we could probably agree that James Wan is really good at mixing horror that has, like, a lot of good traditional jump scares that, as somebody pointed out in a video I watched once, he doesn't do, like, jump scares that are fake scares. For the most part, his stuff is, like, really meant to be a threat when it happens.
And he also likes to do the whole you expect the jump scare, and he's like, it ain't a jump scare. There's nothing going to happen. It's just he builds this tension.
Right. It's really palpable.
Yeah.
And he usually has, I feel like, good stories, too. And that's really kind of a key thing for me, is, like, have to kind of be interested in the characters and the story, and that's something.
But I will say it's on Netflix, both Conjuring, and if you want to watch Insidious, the first one, they're both on Netflix.
Really good movies.
Both highly recommended.
So I had one of my board game nights this week, and played a game that is in our demo library, which I would highly recommend to people, called Clip Cut Parks.
Mm-hmm.
It is a game.
You said Clip Cut Parks.
Clip Cut Parks.
Okay.
We have some on the new wall. It just came in recently. Basically, everybody has a stack of 5 parks cards that have a layout on them of different either colors or, in some cases, there's a pet icon and there's a recycling icon, and you have to put pieces on there that have either that color or that icon. And
it's like city parks,
yeah,
kind of
yeah.
thing.
And so the thing that makes this work is that basically everyone gets a sheet of these little icons of parks, like different colors. And they have, you know, the icons and that kind of thing. And the way the clip cut works is you roll a die, and the dice tells you how many cuts you make with scissors on these pieces of paper.
Mm-hmm.
So you cut, like, 1 or 2 lines, and you're slowly trying to figure out how to cut pieces out so that they fit into the parks you have. And that's by making the cuts, like, 1 or 2 or 3, and everybody rolls in every turn. And as you're cutting them out, you're trying to be the first to complete 5 park cards.
Mm-hmm.
The trick is that if you're cutting and you're not careful, you can wind up cutting a stack of, like, 5 park tiles out that you can't use. And if you can't, you have to crumple it up.
Ugh.
And if you crumple it up, those count against you of a tiebreaker. Like, whoever's the most crumpled, if there are 2 people win at the same time,
mm-hmm.
you would lose based on that. So it's basically about sort of planning ahead. The cutting out paper is kind of a fun mechanic. It's like the write and roll games that I've made a few of those, like that Welcome to the Neighborhood that I liked.
Hmm.
And it's very different. I think you definitely do it with, like, younger players.
Mm-hmm.
We had a ton of fun playing it, and it's an unusual game. It comes with 4 different pairs of scissors. It comes with a pad full of different parks cards and that kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
I really enjoyed it, and I would definitely recommend people go try it out from our demo library.
What's the runtime?
Oh, it was probably like 20 minutes.
Okay.
And it's not even that hard to learn. It's a pretty easy thing to learn. And then, Nick, you and I both watched a show on Netflix called Living With Yourself.
Yep.
Which stars Paul Rudd. And also Paul Rudd.
And Paul Rudd. Yes.
And I forget who his wife is played by. But this
we talked about this a few weeks ago.
We saw the trailer for it, and then, of course, Netflix drops trailers and then drops the show 2 weeks later.
Exactly.
This is... Would you describe it as a comedy?
It's kind of a dark comedy.
Yeah.
Not quite in the vein... It reminded me a lot of Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind meets Multiplicity.
I can see that. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That makes sense.
Because there is, like... I mean, he's definitely sort of depressed on the outs.
Yeah. He's not advertising. He's in marketing.
Yeah, marketing, essentially. He was the hot shot, but basically he spiraled a little bit.
He's lost his edge. His wife wanted him to have a baby. He can't... And he hasn't even gone into the testing and stuff. Yeah. Like, he's clearly, like... depressed.
And then a guy at work tells him about a spa.
Yeah. So he goes to the spa, and then it turns out the spa is actually an illegal human cloning operation.
Yep.
That they cloned him, they removed all the impurities, and they're supposed to murder the original.
Yeah, they're supposed
to. And he survived it.
Basically opens with him crawling out of his own grave. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. But so he and his clone, who didn't know he was a clone, suddenly you're dealing with, like, well, there's two of us, we're both in love with the same woman, we both need this job, one of the guys, his clone is better at everything than he is.
Yep.
And so it's a back and forth about, well, what do we do here? And
but he's not perfect. He has flaws of his own, and it's interesting. I think one of the most interesting things about the show was how it dealt with sort of time.
Yeah.
And it kind of, time and perspective.
Yeah.
Because you would see... one day that was all what the clone did,
and then you jump back and see
what Paul Rudd, the main Paul Rudd, did.
Yeah.
So it was very kind of unique and interesting in that way. I actually think the dynamics with, like, the wife and how that sort of works itself was very interesting.
Yeah.
Some of the later stuff towards the end of the season was very interesting. With
it takes some twists and turns I wasn't expecting.
Yeah.
There's secrets and things that come out before I expected them to, and I always like when they do that kind of thing.
Yeah, I know there's a larger story at work here,
yeah.
And I want to see that, and I think we're going to get that in the season two.
Yeah.
It reminds me a little bit of the Drew Barrymore and Timothy Oliphant.
Yeah, Santa Clarita Diet. It's got that vibe, yeah.
Yeah, how that sort of, there's more to it, and I hope it gets enough views or whatever, however Netflix determines...
that it doesn't get canceled abruptly like that one did.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, and also, I mean, if you like Paul Rudd, he's great here.
I mean...
Playing multiple versions of himself, he's got that sort of winning charm in both versions. And I like the actress they've got playing his wife. I thought she was interesting, too. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. I enjoy it. All right, we're going to close out. We're going to give a spoiler warning, just in case you haven't watched it, for Watchmen on HBO. We have watched the first episode. We're going to talk about it. We're going to dissect it and speculate. So we're going to spoil things. If you have not watched it yet, I think the general consensus is...
check it out.
We all really liked it.
Yes.
And you should go watch it before you listen to it. And now, spoiler barrier up.
Yep.
Let's talk about Watchmen.
All right, let's do it. Was it what any of us expected it to be?
Kind of, yes.
Yeah.
And that you, like, expected the unexpected from Lindelof?
Yeah. I think that...
Because it's kind of a WTF kind of show.
Well, here's the thing. Once I knew that he was doing sort of a modern day sequel,
mm-hmm.
And having watched The Leftovers, which is bonkers and weird and sort of dark and melancholy.
Yeah.
This is what, if you had told me the guy who made Leftovers is going to make a Watchmen sequel, yeah, this is exactly what I've expected.
Well, I had to, before the premiere, I think you posted an article of, like, what to. I read a couple of those just to sort of prime myself to, like, see how exactly it works with the comic,
because
I knew it was basically going to ignore the movie,
yeah,
even though there is a sort of musical choice that was used in Snyder's movie.
Is there?
Yeah, there is towards the end.
Okay.
We'll get back to that.
But otherwise, it takes place in the comic universe. Yeah, it takes place 30 years after the completion of the original Watchmen.
Right, so 30 years after
the devastation
in New York and all of that.
So once I knew that, I was sort of like, okay, that's all I really need to know. I can just jump in.
You know, I'll say this, although Alan Moore sort of doled out information slowly in Watchmen about the setting,
yeah.
He was fairly linear. Lots of flashbacks and things like that, but overall, there wasn't the story, I guess there was a lot of mystery in the original Watchmen graphic novel. I was just trying to think of how this compares tonally to it. Because this has a lot more like, wait, what is even going on? What was that?
Well, it opens up with the,
Was it Tulsa Race Riot? Is that what it's commonly
called?
Yeah,
1921, which is a real historical event that not a lot of people knew. I didn't know about it.
Yeah.
300 African-Americans were killed.
Right. It was kind of like a... it's an incident. If nothing else, Watchmen is like kind of help bring attention to, although I believe Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote an article about it for The Atlantic or something like that, which I think is what put it on Damon Lindelof's radar. So right. So credit to original source there for kind of bringing it back into historical, you know, perspective here. But yeah, it was like it was essentially the sort of Black Wall Street of the area, more well-to-do area.
I think my wife and I were watching it. We were like, "What?" She was like, "Is this part from like the comic or is this reference thing?" Where I'm like, "No, this is completely new."
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It's shocking.
And it was horrific.
It was
right.
Awful.
Yeah. And yes, it's these. It was essentially a sort of violent white assault on a black neighborhood with murders. How many people died?
300.
300.
Yeah, it's insane. Can you imagine?
They at the time they reported it was like 30.
Yeah.
And then they like found a mass. They went looking for the mass grave and found it. And yeah, clearly the history had been sort of swept out of the rug.
This showed like places burned down and stuff.
And that was yeah.
It feels very surreal, and you feel like you're maybe seeing part of like Watchmen's alternate history. And there, you know, like it does intersect with characters who will play a role in it. But that part is real history, and it does remind me of the same way that Watchmen used real history throughout, whether it was war, like, you know, wartime stuff like Vietnam, or the sort of famous murder of, was it Kitty Genovese?
Yeah.
That sort of shocked Rorschach into being who he is. Well, I don't remember, he recounts it, it's not the triggering incident for him, but Watchmen, like, as a comic, addressed some darker chapters in American history, and this was I thought an interesting start.
Yeah, and it focuses on a young boy who basically his parents are trying to get out of the riots, and kind of leads to what, modern day Tulsa? Yeah.
I thought that was an interesting sequence because to me it read very much, and I know this had to be intentional, As a version of the Superman story.
That was
Krypton, and the parents were trying to get their son a safe haven out of a self-destructing world.
Yeah. You know, I didn't even recognize that until you're just now saying it.
It was one of the things that popped for me while I was watching it. There was like one sort of like car that they could sneak the kid into, and there was only room for one.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so this kid goes off, and we don't know, it's not sort of some literal one-to-one thing where this kid is now Superman, but in a world where Watchmen, where Dr. Manhattan is the sort of Superman of the world,
but he is unique.
There is something about this kid, and there could be a connection to Dr. Manhattan, so it may be a very explicit like Superman reference in that sense.
We'll see. There's so much in this. Like, I've already read like three or four different deep dives on it.
Yep.
There's so much to be analyzed about this.
So let's just go and hit some broad strokes. What do we got as sort of basic plot?
Well, the basic plot is that the police in Tulsa were attacked on what they call the White Night. They were attacked in their homes, and as a result, the police now wear masks and hide their identities, and they have a sort of superhero core that operates within the police department that wear costumes and masks and all that kind of thing.
And it's kind of like dark, like not Marvel superheroes, but like those Watchmen type ones, even like, you know, where there's a little bit of homemadeness, but like a little bit above homemade too.
Yeah.
They all have
like code names. They don't use their real names.
Yeah, and there's a shooting with an officer early on, and they use that to sort of reveal that basically they pretend to have other jobs. They don't tell people they work for the cops. There's also they definitely, in order to sort of stave off the cops as good guys thing, which has become a little problematic.
Yeah.
It's a heavily African-American community.
Right.
And heavily African-American cast as far as the leads. And so that...
And also, I although they are going up against sort of a racist organization, essentially a sort of an anti-government Klan movement.
Yeah.
I don't believe that they're necessarily meant to be painted in the brightest of lights themselves.
No.
Right. They're using the same sort of methods that Watchmen was always about. Was about Superman's being sort of proto-fascist.
Right. The notion. Literally the Latin quote that Watchmen takes its name from is essentially that translates as "who polices the policeman."
Yeah.
So this by making policemen at the center of it, they kind of get, to the core of it once again. At a time when, like, race is super heightened in our face.
Well, I think the podcast that I listen to, my friend does, called Zupod's The Watchmen, they talked about, you know, when Moore did his graphic novel, he was dealing with the fears of the time, nuclear war and that kind of thing. Yeah. The fears right now are, racial tensions, civil
unrest,
war, and that kind of thing. And so that is, it makes sense for him to address that with Watchmen.
Yep. Lead character is played by
Regina King. She's great.
She plays Mother Night, I believe?
Sister Night.
And was she, by the way, just a real quick flashback. The cops were initially sort of, the attack on them happened on what they call the White Knight.
Yeah.
Do we know exactly what that name means yet?
We don't, but I'm guessing it was 7th Cavalry You know, 7th Cavalry is a reference to Custer.
Yep.
Right.
That's why they use Little Bighorn as their signal.
Yep.
I love that, this is one of the things that Moore does that drives me a little crazy. He will do, especially as he went on, like League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, had all the, you need annotations to read it.
Yeah. Right.
Like, there's all these, I think Lindelof does it more deftly. I think there's a lot of references here, there's a lot of depth. But you don't need to know it to understand the story.
Right.
But you can deep dive into it, and I think that's a better way to do it.
I will argue, I will say that I think when Moore was writing Watchmen, he wasn't, there's, most of the references are relatively self-contained.
Yeah.
You know, you can read a quote from All Along the Watchtower that's, or an epigraph to the book, and you don't necessarily need to, you know, to go diving into something to get some reference to
it. I think as he went on, he got more self-contained.
Definitely as he went on, for sure.
But I like that. I think Lindelof, I think, went out of his way to try to make something that, were Alan Moore not just dead set against it, he would like. I think.
I almost think he would, because I actually remember that Alan Moore went out of his way to say that he liked the sort of novelistic approach of The Sopranos.
Yeah.
And I think, I'm sure he appreciated that it wasn't sort of a moralizing story.
Well, of course, he's not just ripping off Watchmen. He's based in that world, but there's only one character so far who might even have been from Watchmen.
Yeah,
right. It doesn't feel like a cheap cash grab. It felt like, in a way, like I suppose what Moore sort of would always said that he wanted, which was, he didn't want somebody to imitate him. He wanted somebody to try to push themselves to be innovative in the same way he was trying to push himself to be innovative. But just find some other path.
And I feel like Lindelof has done that, but I feel that Moore at this point is so burnt by the whole thing that he would never we want
to acknowledge. I would not say we should go looking for his approval of it.
No.
But I do think that, like, if somehow it comes across him, he might enjoy it.
Yeah.
I
certainly did.
let's see. Don Johnson also gets a very notable role in this.
Don Johnson plays the chief, Judd.
The only person who doesn't wear a mask.
Yeah. Judd something?
Yeah.
Which I believe to be a pseudonym, as I predicted in our previous... Yep. I'm pretty sure he's Night Owl.
Yeah, I think so too. Just with all the little snippets here and there that were sort of...
Yeah.
There's always an owl, whatever scene he's in.
Unless they were, like you said, they're going out of their way for misdirection, that may be their one kind of, we're going to be a little bit upfront about this so that speculation can have one thing straight up.
But I like seeing all the things. I liked seeing Holmes Mason's...
His biography
on his desk.
He straight up has the owl ship.
Yeah.
He straight up has
the cops,
Archie.
The cops have access to it.
By the way, that shootout with the 7th Cavalry?
Yes.
That was great.
It was intense.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty brutal. They've got like a minigun mounted on like a truck or whatever, and while the police sort of vigilante squad is approaching, they're like mowing through all these cows.
Yeah, with they all take cover behind cows.
Yeah, it's a little bit weirdly Saving Private Ryan-ish.
Can we quick talk about the music?
Yes, I was going to say.
It's Trent Reznor.
It's Trent Reznor and...
Oh, I forgot that.
And Atticus Ross.
Yeah, it's the same
who worked on Social Network and Girl with Dragon Tattoo.
Yeah.
The music is so good. When she gets in her car, and like her supercar, and goes, that's such a great sequence.
And when they're like, when the first sort of barrage of from the minigun, and she's running, just sort of it amps the scene.
I'll have to watch it again. By the way, the cars are all electric cars per Dr. Manhattan's alternate future?
Yeah, there are no cell phones.
Oh, wow, I hadn't noticed that.
There is not a single cell phone. That's why they use pagers.
They use pagers. Oh, my God, you're right.
Why are there no cell phones?
It's just a weird thing.
Because of the cancer thing. The lithium batteries and all that
there's
stuff.
There's no cell phones.
Oh, man, that is interesting. There is also, like, there's casual mentions of lots of Watchmen's alternate history stuff, like Vietnam becoming
a
state.
Sister Knight is from Vietnam as a state. She grew up there.
The 51st state.
Yeah.
By the way, what a great name for a fake bakery.
What's the fake
bakery? Milk and Hanoi.
Yeah.
Oh.
It's so good.
Yeah.
what, Nixon Town is sort of like a
it's where the Seventh Cavalry basically lives.
But they also Nixon's face is on the the.
Oh, and the
monument.
And the Redfordations thing.
The Redfordations.
Right, so yeah, Robert Redford is president. He is in his 30th year or something like that?
Yeah, yeah.
They kind of ran with the notion, I guess, that he would be a modern FDR.
Yeah.
You know, Moore's conception was to have it parallel Reagan, but with him taking it where an actor becomes president, but instead it's sort of a... even though I don't think Moore thought he would be a good president, he still had the notion of a sort of a more liberal-minded president would in the era of inspiration that would come after the all the massive death from the New York attack, that it would sort of be a liberal-minded New Deal that puts it all together. Yeah. So he has been apparently they have like waived various rules just like FDR.
Yep.
He's been had multiple terms, and they're from what I've gathered. Essentially, they're part of one of his acts as president was to make reparations to black folks, right?
Descendants. I think not just black. I think anyone who'd been subjected to inequality by the United States, which is a pretty big list.
Yeah. But you see, kind of a little punk kid, trying to like sort of start something with the what's her character's name?
Sister Knight. I don't remember what her character name is.
Regina King.
Yeah.
Saying that, wondering if she got the money to like fund her bakery with Redfordations.
Yeah.
Which is like their portmanteau of reparations and Robert Redford.
Yeah. It's like Obamacare. It's their
exactly.
Right. And I love when her kid just goes after that kid.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yep.
Also, it rains squids now.
It does rain squids.
Yeah, that was a weird scene. Like, there's alarms, like warning.
It's a thing.
Like, air raid sirens are going off. The sky gets dark. And they, like, everybody, like, rolls up their windows and kind of gets inside. And then, like, almost like little, like, larval squids.
Yeah.
Like, impact and, like, seem to all die on impact. It's not like it's an attack or something.
No.
It feels like it's a weird side effect, either of the original Ozymandias plan somehow, in ways we have no idea yet,
right?
Or something we don't know. We haven't seen the connection yet.
And let's talk about Ozymandias, who's never named in this episode. Come on, that's who it is.
We think. Yeah, they were being a little weirdly coy about it.
Or he's a clone of Ozymandias.
I don't know. It's Jeremy Irons playing it.
Yeah.
He's got these servants who call him Master and who seem a little off.
I swear they're like automatons.
Either robots or clones.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
One of them hands him a horseshoe to cut a cake.
Yeah.
I couldn't quite figure out what the symbolism there was.
Yeah, doesn't he say, he's like, this is a horseshoe?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then these guys like, oh, a knife would be better.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's weird. You know what? Here's the one argument I would make that it's not him. That they've been coy about it. When they asked with the cast, they're like, who's he playing? He's like, they kind of joked and said, well, he's probably playing who you think he's playing. But why would they do that if there wasn't something to be done?
Yeah.
If he was Dr. Manhattan, as much as said that he was tired of life on Earth and he thought he might, at the end of Watchmen, and he thought he might go create some of his own.
But
he
was talking about back on Mars.
Now he was talking about going off planet.
They show him on Mars in the episode.
Do they?
Yeah, yeah. It's on like a TV.
Dr. Manhattan can be in multiple places at once.
Yep, exactly.
In fact, that's that's plot points in the original graphic novel.
Is it possible,
I wondered if these could be like attempts at life from him.
Is it possible that Louis Gossett Jr. and Jeremy Irons and Blue Man on Mars are all Dr. Manhattan?
It's possible.
I could see that. There's a weird mystery that comes to fruition at the end, which seems to has a. There's the foreshadowing to it is almost such that it has to be something Dr. Manhattan related.
Time. Yeah,
because somebody says something early in the episode that's prescient about something that happens at the very end of the episode.
Yeah.
There's just no way you could have had that without there being some out of time thing.
Yeah. This was fascinating. It was beautiful to watch. The music was great. The casting is good. Like
somehow Oklahoma the Musical is also a key to it. And multiple times.
Don Johnson is great.
It all takes place in Tulsa.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah, you know, I kind of like... Yeah, it's just a fascinatingly different vibe to it.
Yeah, and the thing is, like, it needs the Watchmen story, like, the elements of Watchmen, but it doesn't rely on Watchmen. You said your wife hadn't read the graphic novel.
No.
She enjoyed the show.
Yeah, she was very interested in sort of all the kind of trappings and story ideas. She was like, oh, Redford's president? How does that work? And, you know, all the Nixon stuff.
That's what I think. And I honestly, I feel like there's sort of a mixed blessing that Zack Snyder made the movie. because it means nobody's going to try to remake the movie.
Yeah.
And I would rather see this. I would rather see further exploration of the concept than to see Lindelof just do a updated version of Watchmen or something like that. He's clearly, like, taking something he loved and trying to build a new story out of it.
Yeah. The movie also, like, for one thing it did is, like, it exposed the bare bones of the story to people, and even if they, hopefully they read the graphic novel and got a deeper cut, but I think you could watch the movie and jump into this, and other than the changed ending with the alien squid thing, you would at least kind of know what the idea was.
I also think we've seen, they further explored Watchmen. They did before Watchmen. They've done Doomsday Clock.
Yeah.
And I feel like those both have their merits, but this is more what I wanted. This is on the level of the original graphic novel so far. This feels like it's got higher aspirations.
I'm not sure if I'm quite ready to say that, but I'm saying it. I'll say it has the potential to be up.
Yeah, I actually really liked the before Watchmen stuff. Not all of it,
I
but
do
I
too.
Thought
it's a different kind of. Its aspirations were not so high.
Yeah,
no,
that's what I say. Yeah, it's only one.
Or its ambitions,
then.
I guess.
It's only one episode, and I can't say, oh, it's as good as Watchmen. I can say that it seems like their aspirations are to be on that level, and I appreciate that.
Right.
Even if they fall on their face, I appreciate them
right.
aiming.
Right. Nobody else has really quite done that. All of the before Watchmen stuff is, I think, pretty readable, except for Len Wein's stuff. and I do think people should check that out if they just want to see some more of those characters.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
But if you want something of that, what am I reading, what's going on vibe that you got when you read Watchmen the first time, maybe, then the show is kind of delivering so far.
Yeah, this is going to be appointment viewing for me. I'm going to be watching this every Sunday night. I'm super excited to see the next episode.
Yeah. I'm curious to see where some of these characters go if they do. Like, Looking Glass, I really like. But
oh,
I like,
yeah, Tim Blake Nelson.
Tim Blake Nelson is always good, but his sort of interrogator.
Yeah.
And also the...
He's kind of a weird... He's weird because he sounds kind of rednecky.
Yeah.
But he's got kind of like this... I'm almost like serial killer, sociopathic, like, kind of... intellect
it's
going on behind it.
It's not too far away from Rorschach, honestly.
It's true. I think in a way he's the closest thing the show has to a Rorschach stand-in right now.
Yeah.
And then
you notice when the chief is like using his face to... He tells him to pull down his face. He doesn't say your mask. And that's a Rorschach thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. We haven't even talked about the panda guy.
Hates panda.
I don't even know what to
and
make of
there's
that.
There's what, Red, who's like the Russian...
Yeah. Are we called Red Scare? In his full name Red Scare?
Yeah, he is Red Scare.
Now, do we presume that he was probably part of a mixing of Russian and American cultures
after,
in the peacetime after?
Yeah,
I would imagine.
So.
That was the vibe I got, that was probably the case.
And then there's the TV show that is like a kind of Ryan Kelly kind of, or
there's a TV show that's a backstory.
Yeah, the American Hero.
The American Hero, which is a really interesting idea, and they showed kind of the intro to it with all the Minutemen.
By the way, they used the pirates in Watchmen because the notion was that with real superheroes there weren't superhero comics.
No.
The opening has this sort of like Western Marshall, and I wonder if he's going to use like Western instead of superheroes as his like
that's the next
pop culture
thing.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, that's from 1921, so it could be a real thing for all I know. Reeves is a real person, right?
I think
is a real marshal.
You know, since Watchmen is meant to be like an alternate future, right?
Yeah.
Or like an alternate timeline.
An alternate present.
But past too in the comic where essentially right around the 30s or so, sort of real vigilantes arose and what the pop cultural idea of them kind of got pushed aside in favor of other genres. So yeah, that short film at the silent film that kid's watching at the beginning.
It is. Bass Reeves was the first black deputy U.S. Marshal. He is credited as possibly being the inspiration for the Lone Ranger.
Oh, interesting. Hmm. But yeah, part of this sort of seems to suggest rather than having, I guess, a Night Owl in the comics, the original Night Owl was like the first superhero guy. Or no, Hooded Justice was. And then Night Owl followed it.
Yeah.
And this kind of seems to suggest that maybe like so many things that the first the progenitor was actually a black hero, that this this sort of black Lone Ranger in the silent film in this may actually be the sort of first at least pop icon of a hero that inspires it. I wonder if Hooded Justice might have been inspired by this movie as well to become a hero.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, they're definitely playing around. Like, race will be at the forefront of these storylines.
Yeah. So now that you've heard the longer version of our I think the ultimate pitch is the same it was when we first started, which is go watch this. It's really good.
Yep, I agree.
Watch it twice. You'll find more stuff.
Yes, it's true. All right, that's it for us this week. We'll be back next week in the morning. Until that time,
yo, Joe!
Roguecast is a weekly podcast broadcast from Rogues Gallery Comics and Games in Round Rock, Texas. You can find us online on Facebook and at www.roguesgallerytx.com and email us comments or questions at roguesgallerytx@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.